Good day, folks. Always a pleasure talking with Australians. Got the chance to talk with Bronwyn Reed and found out that her endeavor called Small Company Big Business focuses on helping the small companies dotting the landscape to be able to provide services for the big monolithic business around the world. As a small business owner myself, the very things she helps with made me go, why, oh, why didn't I meet her 5 years ago? But we're here now. She talks about the recent upsets that COVID brought to supply chains and how some huge companies are now turning to small ones and looking for local help to keep them able to hit their bottom line. She's definitely been on that side of the coin and brings years of personal experience from the rural community and helps small companies be seen and heard by the big ones. If you're in that situation and wondering how you can close bigger deals with companies with deeper pockets, listen into this episode. And afterward, find her by heading over to her website, bronwynreed.com.au. What'll we learn today? Keep listening to find out. And stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, this is the first time we've been talking. I know a little bit about your company, but what does your company do? Let's start there.
In short, we help small businesses get ready to do business with big businesses.
Okay.
So a lot of small businesses want to get a contract with a big company so that they can grow. And usually for a small business, when they get that first contract with a big name, that's the spark for rapid growth for them. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, these big companies set a very high bar for their expectations. And for most small companies, it's just too hard and they give up, and therefore they never ever reap the benefits of getting that big name client,
right?
And then growing from there.
Well, goodness, what kind of huge bars do these big companies have for the small guys? Like, is it insurance or something else?
That's one thing, insurance, yeah. Which is sometimes entirely inappropriate. I mean, because often these big companies will have a take it or leave it contract and just a standard contract for everybody. So, you know, the guy who's providing the styrofoam coffee cups is also required to have a $10 million professional liability insurance, which is just goodness, crazy. But they have lots of requirements. You know, some of them even require you to have ISO certifications for environmental quality, safety, mm-hmm, etc. They usually have very high bar in terms of, you know, what systems you've got. They will, you know, forensically examine your financial entrails to make sure that you're financially stable. Mm-hmm. Then what they often do is, and they change those things all the time, then they just have another little brain explosion and change all those requirements. So not only does the small business have to put them in place, they then have to devote time and resources to keep them up to date.
Goodness. So they're constantly like pulling the rug out from under the little guy, I guess.
Yeah, they are not always the most easy customers to deal with.
Yeah. I've had experiences with some of those, and here in the US, it seems like procurement is a big part of that. It's like, guys, come on, move faster. You know, we got all the paperwork signed, but then somebody's on vacation, or somebody, the right person's not there at the right time, or they got busy, and it's like, yo, guys, we got bills to pay, fam, and you've identified a need, we're here, you want us, now let's make this happen, right?
Yes, yes. Procurement can be, you know, a little bit like the Great Wall of China. You know, yeah, it's there to keep out the smaller suppliers. The interesting thing, you mentioned payments. That's another big issue between small companies and big companies when they do business, because often big companies will have very long payment terms, and it's become a very hot issue here in Australia. We've just had some new provisions brought in on the 1st of January.
Good. Does that mean it's going to get faster for you guys?
Well, what it means now, Michael, is that they have to report what their payment terms, but what we really want is legislated payment terms. We just want legislated 30-day payment terms, so that's the only thing that's going to solve it.
My goodness. What's the longest pay period that you've ever run into in your line of work?
120 days as a standard payment term. But this is a world record that Australia has, unfortunately. It's nothing we're proud of. Australian companies are the worst payers in the world.
Oh.
We pay our bills on average, I think it's about 26 or 27 days late.
Oh, my goodness.
So we're streets ahead, and then Mexico comes in behind us.
Oh, I heard there was a company here that I heard they had their pay period set to net 240, if you can believe it. Yeah. They were like, we're going to wait 8 months. It's like, yo, if I waited 8 months to pay my electric bill, I would not have electric. Seriously. Fortunately, I mean, they had a lot of recruitment firms that were on a preferred vendor list. So that's how the small business would get in with the big businesses. They'd partner up with this recruitment firm, which has deeper pockets. And they're like, we'll pay you net 30. And I guess we'll just wait for these guys to pay us when they feel like it. They're probably still being paid to this day. But it's like
huge issue.
It is a huge issue. Yeah. So, well, goodness, you seem like you've really picked a very challenging area to work in. Like, why'd you go and do that to yourself? Why'd you decide to start this company? Yeah, here it is.
I did this on the back of our existing company, which is a 25-year-old environmental consultancy firm.
Okay.
And of course, in that, we deal with lots and lots of really big companies. We do a lot of work in the resources sector. So we deal with the, you know, the BHPs and the Rio Tintos and Anglo American and all the, you know, the really big companies. So after, you know, many, many years of dealing with them, and also my family has a farming background, so they were also delivering to really big companies. So I guess I've had a lifetime of being a small supplier to big companies.
Yeah.
And I made lots of mistakes doing that and wasted money. So eventually I put it all down in a book so that I could perhaps help other people. And now I've turned that book into a program, and I do one-on-one mentoring and training and workshops, just trying to help other small businesses not make the mistakes that I did.
Well, that is very noble of you. And there's a lot of stuff out there that it's almost like there's, like you said, there's this wall, this real thick wall that makes it next to impossible for small businesses to provide their services that these bigger corporations need, but they can't get over the wall. Right. Yeah. So I'm glad you're helping out.
Interesting though, Michael, since the, coronavirus pandemic, what we heard was, you know, the world clanging with the sound of breaking supply chains, because a lot of big companies wouldn't deal with people like me because we're too small and therefore we're a risk. But then, you know, the airplanes stopped and the airport shut and the people stopped moving. So all of a sudden, all of those long supply chains that were supposedly less risk have turned out to be the real risk. So I'm anticipating that a lot of bigger companies, and it's already happening, are going to be looking closer to home for their suppliers.
Yeah.
As a result of the big fright they got.
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like you lull yourself into a false sense of confidence and you think, oh, we're too big to fail. Of course, look at our supply chain. It's resilient until, like, there's a worldwide pandemic that only happens once every 100 years. I mean, when's the last time this has happened, right? Like, so, but that's cool. That's cool. I mean, that and the push toward work from home and remote working too. I think a lot of places, I mean, it's kind of the opposite of what you said, right? But as far as procuring the people to actually execute the work, as opposed to, well, we got to pick from this small area right here, right around our hometown of St. Louis, for example. And now they're like, there's a whole world of people out there. We could hire people from Australia to come do this stuff for us at 6 a.m. their time. how cool is that? So, yeah, I think there's some really good things that happen as a result of COVID. But
absolutely, Michael. In fact, that's my next book is coming out on the 23rd of March.
Oh, yeah.
And I have included a little hopeful section at the back, you know, maybe a little bit self-indulgent, but it's what I hope to see change as a result of the crisis that we are been through and are going through. You know, all of a sudden, the impossible became possible.
Yeah. Wonder of wonders.
Wonder of wonders, exactly.
Yeah. We don't have a work-from-home policy, and then overnight, it's like, hey, everybody's working from home. Y'all are hustling.
Exactly.
Could have done this 5 years ago, but yeah.
Yeah, we couldn't do that before. That was impossible. And, you know, homeless, you know, we had homeless people in hotels.
Mm-hmm.
Hello?
Yeah.
How hard was that?
I know, right? I know. It's interesting seeing how disruptive it is, but it's also a huge blessing to see how people are adapting. And I'm excited. I know it sounds weird to say that about a pandemic, but I am actually excited in seeing what's coming down the pipe. Are you able to share a little bit about what your hopes are, or is that something you want to just wait for the book?
Absolutely. Oh, well, the book is actually, it's called Small Company, Big Crisis.
Okay.
How to Prepare in Advance, Respond Effectively, and Recover in Full. It goes through the first part is, how booms and busts happen. You know, these things happen. We always have another crisis. The next one's going to be along soon, just like the council bus. Mm-hmm. You know, so we need to, it's disingenuous to think, the crisis is the abnormal and the lack of crisis is the normal, because really the crisis is the normal. We just lurch from one crisis to another, continually unprepared. So I talk about that. I do a lot of on how to get prepared if you're a small business owner. Then I go through, what to do when the crisis hits, and then how to get out the other end. And then in my hopeful bit, I look at the first one is fixing income and wealth inequality.
Okay.
Yeah, this is where a lot of this stems from.
Yeah.
I talk about the ethics of business relationships, how we need to look at the ethics, particularly of the relationship between small companies and big companies. I talk about social responsibility, how all companies now, if you are not a business with a purpose now, you're not a business and you are not going to last.
Yeah.
Being a purpose-led business. I talk about local buying, what we were just talking about before, how local buying can be a force for good.
Mm-hmm.
I talk about who's running the joint. Who is running the joint? And the people who are running the joint, do we really want them to be running the joint?
Right.
All our frontline health workers, et cetera.
Yeah, I think as you go over that, and I think we have a lot in common. I think we think along the same lines, there's some things that just need to be disrupted yesterday. Right. So I hear you there. I hear you. So
we should connect offline.
We absolutely should. I think we're going to be friends. What have been some of the major challenges you've overcome on the journey, other than big businesses saying no, have you had some?
Well, the biggest one was that in our environmental consultancy, I don't know if you guys remember, but back in about 2012, 13, there was a general resources industry bust. We were doing a lot of work for the resources industry, and we lost 2/3 of our revenue in about 3 weeks.
Caused that? I don't mean to sound like an ignorant American, but what was that?
A lot of the big companies just withdrew projects. They just shut projects down, and we would just get phone call after phone call. Sorry, projects cancel. Sorry, projects cancel. So we had a signed purchase order or a contract and fully resourced. And they just say, no, sorry, projects finished. So that's where it all came from. In fact, that's where my book came from. It started out as a keynote presentation back in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
Called Rabbit in the Headlights, because that's how I felt. I just felt like a rabbit in the headlights. What do I do? I sort of frozen, You can't think, you can't move. So that's where it all came from, an experience. So we did survive. And, of course, that's where a lot of my experiences come from for the second book. But it took several years to get through. We were pretty wounded. Beaten up and bashed up, but we did survive.
Yeah. You're still there.
We're still
and there. You're still alive. And that's something that I think people hopefully are learning, that things in life that build resilience, they're not a curse. They're a real blessing. Like, how cool is it that we get to come through something and we come out the other side stronger? Like, where else are you going to get that kind of strength? Right.
Yeah. The main thing is that, like, I mean, I don't know if you've been through a similar thing, Michael, but to me, the most important thing is that I can help somebody else to learn because of my experience. I mean, this has happened to so many businesses now during this pandemic. You know, millions of small businesses across the world have folded, lives destroyed.
Yeah.
Families destroyed.
Yes.
So, if we can help, we do.
Until just now, like, first I didn't know that there were people like running companies like what you're talking about, right? Where, hey, you know, we're championing the little guy. We want to help him get in with the big guys. And for some business owners, I think that we think, well, if I can't make this work, then I guess that means I have to go get a job at a big company or something like that, because that's where the money is, you know, because they just keep saying no to the little guy. But, you know, with your strategies that you're talking about, there's definitely a way for them to have hope. They can make it work.
Yep, that is really, really cool. Big companies are different. They're different to your normal, in inverted commas, customers. They think differently. They act differently. They have different motivators. So if you want to go on this journey, which can be a very profitable journey, mind you, you've got to be prepared and you've got to do the work up front. Mm-hmm. I call it paying the price of admission.
Right. Okay. Very cool. Well, I guess, what have you learned about yourself over this journey? Like, you seem to be a pretty introspective lady. Have you noticed some things about yourself? Like, whoa, that's different about me because of this business.
I've noticed that I am pretty damn competitive.
Yeah.
I do have the ability to stick with it and, you know, not lie down. Mm-hmm. I've learned that because at some point in my career, I did do the whole working for big companies thing myself. You know, I'm in corporate escapee, as is my business partner and husband. Mm-hmm. I've learned that I'm a small business person. I don't want to be part of the machine.
Right.
I'm never going back there.
Yeah. Never convert, never surrender. That's what I used to tell people back in my consulting days. And I mean, I guess I can still consult if I really had to, but I've had people, you want to come work full time? Actually, no, I don't. I don't want to. There's just something different about us. You know, there's something different about business owners. Once we go down that path and we have like real true freedom, it's like, There are people that are cut out for corporate world, and we are not those people. And that's okay.
We are not those people.
Yeah. It doesn't mean that the people that work in corporate are busted. There are people that really, really want stability. They don't want to have to worry about that kind of stuff. And it's like, that's great for you, but not for us. So
Having said that though, Michael, you look at the number of people who work for big companies, mm-hmm. who have been laid off as a result of this pandemic, like, Is their future more stable than yours and mine?
Nope. And I tell people that if they're on the fence about, like, I don't know if I should start a business, I'm like, hey, listen, literally anything can happen, guy. And you never know from day to day. Like, you can think that you know what's coming, but you technically don't. Nobody does. Nobody knows. So you might as well. And I look back at my own career, both in corporate and as a business owner, and it's like, man, sometimes I feel like I'm just running with scissors through life. Like, why am I taking so much risk? I'm going to just die. And I'm not dead. I'm here, just like you, right?
Still going.
Oh, I'm still going. So it's not nearly as scary as what we think it is. It's just that perceived fear, which I was just talking with somebody earlier today, it's manufactured. We scare ourselves into not doing things, but it's like, it's not actually a thing that's happening right now. So just do it. What's the worst, literal worst that can happen?
Go broke.
Yeah.
Get up, do it again. You guys have got a really proud tradition of that. We don't have so much of a proud tradition of that in here in Australia. The other thing I've learned about myself, Michael, is that I love small business, and I was a part-time university lecturer for 12 years. Mm-hmm. So the two things that make me really, really happy are small business and education.
Okay.
So what I do now with the speaking, workshops, writing, content, mentoring, it's the intersection of those two things, small business and education. And that's just what I love. So I'm in my happy space.
Nice. So you found, so you basically have combined the cool things about your life into something that gives you a really unique niche that not many other people, frankly, I'm scared to death to do the kind of stuff that you're doing. So I will not be competing with you. Why? Because it just seems so stinking hopeless. Like, I love hearing no from people, but it seems like you're hearing probably 100 times more no's from bigger corporations. And I'm like, yeah, I'm a pretty upbeat guy, but that would just wear me down.
That's where that's the competitive thing comes in. You know, you just don't.
Yeah.
You don't. I mean, yeah. If I look back now at my the first tender that I wrote for an international mining company, embarrassment, you know, all the stuff I had to learn to actually get to the point where I can write a winning tender now. So
yeah.
You just keep plugging along.
You do.
And
you
they just, keep saying no.
Yeah. You keep going and eventually they will say yes, they will. And then you look back and you're like, dang, I've really come a long way. But if you don't keep walking, you don't keep taking the steps, like you won't be able to look back and say that. And you won't get a yes if you just stop. So, but still, it's scary.
It is. The other thing that's a part of my ecosystem is regional development, regional small business. Because I don't live in a big city. I live, you got a sort of a general shape of Australia.
Mm-hmm. Sort of yeah, northeast. It looks like a croissant, kind of, yeah.
Yeah, northeast bit,
right.
Out, you know, several hundred miles from the coast. So yeah. I'm very driven, you know, and a lot of our governments think that there's nothing outside our capital cities, probably the same as yours, but at least, like, your population is spread from coast to coast. Right. Ours is just all on the edges and there's nothing in the middle. So sometimes we have to fight to get our politicians and our leaders to remember that we're actually here.
Yeah.
You know, we do good stuff out here. So that's the other part of my advocacy.
Yeah. Is advocating for people so that they're seen by the government?
It's advocating for regional development.
Okay.
Yeah. Because there's some really smart people out here.
Yeah. That's the same here too. I mean, we've got some sparsely populated areas and stuff. And then we've got on the East and West Coast are, you know, famously really, really populated. And it's like, hey, I live on the outskirts of St. Louis here and we only have a few thousand people in our city, but by George, we're doing some cool stuff out here. Look at us and bring us in for some stuff. But yeah, I mean, it's always an uphill battle, but that's okay. We're supposed to, building business is supposed to be hard. It's supposed to be difficult.
So do you find that, this is one thing that I rail about. No, if you go to say New York or San Francisco or Los Angeles, that because you're from a regional area, you're presumed to have a lower IQ than if you came from New York or San Francisco.
That would be a great question to ask somebody that's been to either of those places. I feel bad. I mean, you know, the US is big, right? And we do a lot of travel, but we tend to travel to places where our family is, and our family also lives in places like where we live, right? So we haven't really, like, we've been to places similar to that, like metropolitan areas. I mean, St. Louis proper is right here. They kind of feel that way, but they still are like, yeah, you're one of us. Get in here, you know, and they're not, if they think that, they don't actively be all like a bunch of yokels coming around here, you redneck. They don't do that sort of thing. Bogan. They don't call us that. I learned what that word meant the other day. I had another Australian guest and she called me a bogan. And I'm like, is that bad? I asked the second guest and I'm like, what is that? What does that mean? So, but she's like, yeah, it's like a redneck. And I'm like, yeah, I'll take it. That's fine. That's accurate. She's right. I'm a bogan.
That's a bit rude.
Well, yeah, no, it was in good jest. I think we were joking around with each other and she's like, you look like a bogan. And I'm like, thanks. So I don't know. But yeah, we have regions like that, but I mean, there's always going to be like a lot of snark from other cities. And I think it's just because it's another city. Like you can take somebody from a metropolitan, like Cleveland in Ohio, and take them and bring them to like San Antonio, Texas. And they'll be like, what a bunch of backwards, you know? And it's just because it's two different cities, right? We're basically a nation of states that hate each other, yeah. But we play nice.
We know. We tolerate each other.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, we don't really like you guys, but okay, you know, but yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, what do you wish someone told you about entrepreneurship 5 years ago? You know, if you can go back and learn a piece of information, what would that be?
5 years ago. That building a second and a third business on top of one business is really hard.
Oh, yeah. Note to self, Fritz, don't do that.
Yes. Yeah. It is hard because what happens is that your personality and your brain space gets split between the two. This business is my third business. So, but we're still running the environmental consultancy. So I'm still a director of it. And it's a reasonable size company. And then I branched off and started Small Company, Big Business. And I didn't really understand what it took to do two at the same time.
Yeah.
Because our environmental business isn't large enough to have, wasn't then large enough to have like a general manager where we could step back completely from operations. So then I launched out and wrote a book and started doing speaking and running a second business. Yeah. So possibly somebody warned me that it's not easy to do two at once.
Yeah. It'd be like, whoa, slow your roll. Make sure you get like down to like 10 hours a week max on your first business before you roll over and do. Well, have you found like any overlap between the two businesses or three businesses? Like, are there, like, you're not devoting 40 hours a week every week to each business, right? Because, like, I assume you sleep sometimes.
Yeah.
A couple hours a day.
Well, yeah, very much so, because everything, it's what I've done in the environmental business that has allowed me and given me the experience and the lessons, some expensive, to be able to do what I do in the new business. So the two actually are inextricably intertwined.
Yeah.
Because one leads directly into the other.
That's cool. I was concerned. I'm like, is she going to like work like 167 hours a week and then only have 1 hour for like everything else, life, and then okay, next week. So that's cool.
Yeah,
always wanted to start up another business, but I'm not to the place yet where I can do that comfortably and maintain my sanity. So yeah. I'm going to take that.
Do you have a family?
I sure do. And I got four girls and a wife, and it's like, I got to spend time there too. So we'll get there. Yeah. I'll put them to work.
I did. My two children, they're now 26 and 22. They know what it's like. But one's already gone out and working for herself.
Yeah.
That was the inevitable path for her. Yes.
The apple does not fall far from the tree.
No, it does not. No.
I love it. Well, I got one last question for you. So do you have any sage advice for people, like if they're just starting on their business owner journey or if they've been on the path for a while, like what one awesome piece of advice do you want to share with the world?
I'll make it one piece of advice, but in two parts.
Okay.
One, start getting your business systemized the day you start your business. Don't wait until you have employed your fifth employee and you're running around trying to do everything yourself and control these five people and you're earning less money than you were when you started. Start getting your systems organized from day one. How do we do this? How do we do it properly? And who has to do it? Okay. The second part of that is that you must do right from the start is think of the exit. Okay. Most entrepreneurs now, I'm now over 60. So people often wait till they're my age to start thinking about the exit. There are a flock of baby boomers wanting to sell their businesses. So you've got to start thinking about the exit right back at the start. I know you're all excited about starting and, you know, putting your shingle up outside the door, but start thinking about the exit.
Yep. Start finding that's good stuff. And I wish I had taken both of those under advisement 5 years ago, because I just sort of was like, well, I'm making a business. Yeehaw. And it's like,
yeah. Let's go.
I know, right? I guess that's that American side of me that's just like, do it, just adventure. And it's like, I didn't really think about like plans and process. Like, that's new stuff to me. Like, why would I want structure? That just gets in the way of creative thought. Don't tell me how to think. Oh my goodness. It gives me the heebie-jeebies saying that now. It's like, I don't know how I survived this long, but that's really good advice. It's really good advice. Ultimately, I think every business owner would like to have something that they can walk away from and it still runs, and that somebody else would be like, I'll buy that for like money dollars and you make a pretty penny, you know? Mm. So it's cool stuff.
And it's also about leaving a legacy.
Yeah. You know,
it's leaving something good behind.
Right.
You know, we're all not here to just take, you know, we're all here to give as well. So, So start thinking about that right from the start. So now, Michael, you can go away and spend the rest of your day thinking about exiting.
Yeah. How am I going to sell this critter? Man, it's like an albatross around my neck. Good Lord. No, I enjoy being a business owner. I do want to get to the point where I can sell the company. But I'm having a lot of fun right now, Bronwyn, and this is good stuff. It's good stuff. Yeah. But I want to start up more businesses too. I just want to keep going. I'm addicted. Well, it's been awesome chatting with you. Well, I think that a lot of people are probably going to hear this and think, well, I need to talk with her and get some more information, because there's a lot of small businesses out there. And I think there are a lot more now because of COVID, because they got let go and they're like, I'm finally going to do this thing on my bucket list. Now what? Well, how would they reach out to you? Like, is there, I assume you have maybe an email or a website or something. Yeah.
The website's the easiest, is just bronwynreed.com.au.
All righty. There we go. Well, I will put that in the show notes for you and see if I can attract you some more business. All right.
That'd be fantastic, Michael.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate your time. I love chatting with Australians. Yeah. I get it. Like, I get called names all the time. I didn't take it personal. I didn't think she was calling me, you know, something bad or whatever, but I am a bogan. Okay. I'm just going to go on the record and say that now that I know what it means. But I was so like, what is that? Is that bad? Oh my goodness.
You own it, man. You own it.
I own it. It's the beard. I think it's the beard. It's the beard in this hat. I think it's what it is. Well, it's been amazing talking with you, and I look forward to getting this pushed up real soon. I'll let you know when it goes live. All right.
Okay. You have a fabulous rest of your day.
All right. You too. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Did you hear this episode and go, wow, I'm a founder and all my friends keep telling me I should get on a podcast. Would I be a fit? Yes. Yes, you would. Every single person who steps out of their comfort zone to build their dream has an amazing story to share. And this is the platform for you to do that. If you want to talk about your dream, what led you to start your endeavor, what successes you've had or challenges you've been pitted against, this is the podcast for you. So head on over to archdevops.com/podcast to find out how to get on. And also check out our free tip sheets on guesting or even hosting your own podcast. This is Fritz, your host, hoping to meet you on the other side of the hot mic at ArchDevOps.